A Mud Podcast presents.
Cece said, this is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. I've been doing this show for quite a long time, and it comes out of work I did with the Mainstream Media Project, putting people on the air to try and bring alternative voices and viewpoints and progressive ideas into the media, something that is sorely needed all the time, especially these days. And one of the people we work with at that point, and then I'm so glad to bring back to the show today, is Kathy Kelly. Kathy is board president right now of World Without War, I think.
World Beyond War.
World Beyond War. You see, I'm shuffling through all my papers here and don't have the one I need right in front of me. World Beyond War, but has been involved with so many organizations over the years, Voices in the Wilderness, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and has been just an activist on important issues her whole life. Just looking through your Wikipedia entry and reminding myself about the things that you've been involved in, Kathy, we could do a whole show just about that, many shows, and all of the different areas that you've worked on and that we appreciate you taking the lead on. What the impetus behind me bringing you on today was a release talking about the emergency meeting held by the Hague Group in July. The Hague Group launched in January 2025 a bloc of states committed to coordinated legal and diplomatic measures in defense of international law and solidarity with the people of Palestine. And we will get to that. They did have on the 16th of July their emergency convening where they came up with 6 points. But as we know right now, there's a lot of groups coming out with statements about what needs to be done in the territories. But we just cannot avoid what's the elephant in the room, which is that there's a disastrous situation going on in Gaza right now with thousands of people starving every day. And just the situation is so utterly appalling and disastrous that we just have to start there. I mean, how does the world react to the situation? I know I can talk about the many statements that are being issued from different groups and the petitions that are out there, but this has got to be particularly distressing to you and the work that you've done, including the many times that you've been to the region.
Well, Cece and Jimmy, thank you very much for inviting me to Global Stuff. It's great to be with you again. And yes, this is a time that I think has many people waking up in the morning and feeling miserable. Miserable because a genocide is unfolding before our very eyes. I mean, I can remember as a teenager seeing a film about the Nazi genocide and Holocaust that cost so many lives of European and other people, European Jews and others in that area. And I said to myself, I would never stand on the sidelines or be a bystander watching in the face of such horrible evil. I would have taken some kind of action. And yet, you know, it seems that in spite of many actions, vigorous, determined actions, Israel continues its genocide. Today, a number of families were huddled together in the Cairo Girls Elementary School in Gaza City. And these were families that had already been displaced, forcibly displaced. And there were women and children. And Israel bombed that school during the Friday prayers. They used United States manufactured weapons to do it. A Hellfire missile fired Lockheed Martin manufactured AGM-114K2 rockets. Portions of it were found in the debris. At least 5 people were killed. 22 were wounded, including several children. And can you imagine, you know, if an elementary school in your neighborhood is bombed, then you would imagine the sirens of the ambulances and the fire trucks coming. But Gaza is so destroyed, there aren't even hospitals that can receive those who have survived these bombings. And the doctors and the nurses in the hospitals say they can barely stand. Their legs are shaking because they're hungry also. They're going on a few spoonfuls of rice. And so, Jimmy, I think about the White Rose, the collective of young students in Germany who, oh, they must have felt such fear of the Gestapo. But they took action. They painted slogans on the walls in their city of Munich. And in their universities, they distributed flyers. And this was very risky to do. And they were caught. And they were interrogated for 4 days. And they were taken to the guillotine. And they were killed. And, you know, that leaves us gasping. But think about who's bearing witness in Gaza today. 217 Palestinian journalists have been killed because they're trying to tell the story. Doctors are trying to tell the story, and they've been killed again and again, and their hospitals utterly destroyed. And Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, in 2 days' time, will be in his 7th month of imprisonment and torture. And he was the director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital, a civilian doctor. So the doctors and nurses who could bear witness to what's happening are constantly being persecuted. And how do the Israelis find them? Well, they use technology supplied by Google and Amazon and Palantir. And they track down their prey. And they use so supposedly precision-guided missiles and kill them, or snipers kill them, but also that occasions many women and children being killed as well. And now those who survive, when they go to these 4 hubs to try and get food and water, and you've got to have water. If you get a box of flour but you don't have any water, what can you do with it? If you get a bag of lentils but you don't have any water, what good is it?
Right.
So they need food. They need water. They go to these hubs that a U.S. Group called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, collaborating with the Israeli military and plenty of mercenaries that the U.S. sends, they operate these hubs. And repeatedly, people are mowed down with tank-fired missiles, with missiles that are fired from the Navy ships, the Israeli ships in the sea, and with airborne attacks.
I want to emphasize that point because I think we're seeing that every day. But you're talking about the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Sounds wonderful, but actually an organization that's an Israeli and American organization that is supposedly setting up these distribution points. And yet when the people come to these distribution points, then they're fired upon frequently by the Israeli military. It's like, here, we're setting up this aid for you, and then we're going to wipe you out.
And it's such systematic cruelty. And yet it goes on day after day. And the United Nations organizations, United Nations Believe It Works Association, the World Health Organization, the World Food Program, they're, you know, almost like shouting, saying, we have the food. It's in trucks. It's spoiling on the border. Open the border crossing. Open the Rafah border crossing and let that food in. And we have experience with food distribution. But it's almost as though the Israelis and the U.S. as their partner, we're not just complicit, we are partners in this genocide, want to create situations that are full of commotion and havoc. and will almost guarantee that more and more Palestinians will become so malnourished, so weakened, so debilitated that they won't be able to stay on their land. And that's ethnic cleansing. And they're doing it in the West Bank using other methods as well. But I believe this has to be labeled as apartheid, ethnic cleansing, genocidal warfare, using United States weapons. The U.S. provisions the Israelis with the weaponry, but also using U.S. war technology and also using U.S. cover at the United Nations when, shamefully, again in June, the United States was the only country to veto a ceasefire resolution.
And I saw an article today about how now they're planning airdrops of aid. The absurdity of that, which is so hit or miss and not nearly what's needed, when they're, what, how many trucks just waiting at the border, loaded with supplies, waiting to come in, that can't get through the checkpoints? Or it's so hard to believe that they're being kept out. Is it just the Israelis, as you say, wanting to starve the people of Gaza?
Well, this is where I think for Palestinians it becomes even more difficult. Arab countries, Jordan, their neighbor, Qatar, Egypt, are cooperating with that airdrop. And you're right, Jimmy, it doesn't make any sense when the food is, and the medicine and the tents and the fuel are on trucks and could be just driven in, open up the barriers. But these airdrops are going to be coordinated with the Israeli military, and the Israeli military will be checking all of their enormous capacity for technological surveillance, and they want to make sure that they eliminate Hamas. And so that's what their main aim is. If any Hamas people could get their hands on that food, then they have to be eliminated or lured into the places where people get the food and then eliminated. But, you know, there are so many doctors, surgeons that have said they treated children who had sniper bullets in their torso, in their heads. I mean, why are the snipers shooting at children?
Is these are Israeli? Is this IDF, Israeli Defense Force?
Well, it is
snipers. Do we know who they are?
They're also saying that some of the mercenaries working with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation have shot at civilians. There are plenty of war crimes to go around. You know, I hope it's okay if I mention there was a crew of ambulance drivers who went very bravely, very early in the morning, like pre-dawn, to a place where it was said that many people had been killed and there might be rescue possibilities. And so they went with their sirens blaring and the lights going around, and they had their insignia on the trucks. And they arrived where they were supposed to arrive. They'd cleared it with the Israeli military. And when they got there, the Israeli military started firing on them. And they fired bullets into, again, the torsos and the heads of these ambulance workers. And then they buried all of the workers. They were dead. And their ambulance, you know, their vehicles in shallow graves. Now, this was all exposed. And one of the reasons it was exposed is because a man and his son had been just walking by and they saw all of this. So at first they were arrested. But, you know, this 12-year-old kid, Mohammed al-Bardawil, they can't keep him. He's 12 years old. All he did was walk out with his dad. So he was being questioned. What exactly did you see? And they're trying to kind of put together what happened. And then he was out by the seashore, and he was assassinated, a 12-year-old boy who was a witness. So again, I think about the White Rose and that brave witness and how they were brought to the guillotine. But I don't see a difference between that cruelty and the cruelty that has been wreaked upon people trying to give witness within Gaza within Palestine. So then, it becomes incumbent on us. What kind of witness will we give? And I think that boycott and divestment campaign, I hate to say sanctions because I oppose the economic sanctions against Iraq with all my might, but boycott, divestment, sanctions, we as consumers can ask ourselves, is there something I'm consuming that I could stop consuming so that I can be part of this effort to stop the genocide? And it's interesting, Amazon owns Whole Foods, a grocery store chain that has grocery stores all across the United States. And as soon as Francesca Albanese's report came out showing that Amazon was supplying war technology to Israel and that Amazon owns Whole Foods, people in Northampton immediately sprang to action and they started, parking lot demonstrations protesting at Whole Foods, and they managed to turn six people away from going inside the store to shop. So I think wherever we can to take action. Today, I know in Chicago, near where I am, people were out banging pots in front of the Israeli consulate. People are taking action in capitals all around the world, in the hundreds and in the thousands. But like, for instance, in the UK, people took action against the Elbit weapon factories. And these were very vigorous actions, I must say. I was pretty stunned when I saw the extent of damage that they were creating when they went to these factories. I thought they were just standing up on the rooftops with, banners, but they were actually doing damage to the Elbit machinery. Now, if you even hold up a sign that says, I support the Palestine Action Campaign, you're liable to go to prison in the UK because they managed to put through a new law that proscribes that group as terrorists. So we have to be really full of international solidarity right now to say we are not the terrorists. The terror that's being waged against Palestinian people is against international law, it's against human decency, it's against the Geneva Conventions, it's been ruled already. The International Law Court, the International Court of Justice, gave Israel until September 19th, now that's not very far from now, is it?
No.
To stop, to dismantle the Israeli control of the occupied Palestinian territories, to get their military out. Now, who's going to enforce that?
Well, that's a major question. Of any of these statements that are coming out, or the whether it's from the Hague Group that I mentioned, or Amnesty International, or the petition that's been circulated that a variety of groups in this country have signed. I mean, the whole thing, the outrage and the response generally, internationally, is really appalled at what's going on there. And yet, your question that who's going to enforce this? I do want to remind the listeners, this is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. My guest for this show, Kathy Kelly, who's been an important activist. She's the board president of World Beyond War and has been involved with many issues over the years with Iraq and Afghanistan, with the drones. When you're talking about people doing damage to the weapons manufacturers, I know you were at the military bases that deploy the drones, but I guess you were careful about not doing any damage there and still got arrested.
But I did 3 months in prison for that because I tried to deliver a letter and a loaf of bread to the military commander.
So just being there. And I think, I saw your talk about where you mentioned and it goes back to the top of the show where you talked about Nazi Germany and especially myself as a Jew, and many Jews know what was done to the Jewish people And you said we cannot say we did not know. And now it's like flipping the script against the Israelis, the Jewish Israelis, about you've experienced this, the genocide and the attempt to wipe out a whole culture. And now you're consciously, your government is consciously doing that, wanting to round up, put all these people in a very public way into what they're a concentration camp.
Well, you know, there are refuseniks, and that's been very impressive to me. There are young Israeli combatants who say, "That's it. I'm not going to do my next tour of duty. You can't send me back. I won't go. I'll go to jail." And they have. They've gone to prison. Relatively short sentences. But I don't know what the conditions are like in those prisons or how traumatizing it might be. And then there are people who've gone inside the universities and outside the bases in Israel, and they've held up pictures of the children who are no longer alive. They've done demonstrations. So it isn't fair to say that no Israelis are taking action. In the West Bank, there's a very fine group that goes and stays with the Bedouin villagers when the settlers are attacking and tries to, you know, nonviolently, unarmed civilian international protection is what they're trying to offer. And then increasingly now there are internationals joining them. But we don't see anything commensurate to the suffering being caused right now. France will be the 148th state to recognize Palestine as a state. They made that decision today. And 25 Western states in Europe did speak out on Gaza. But, you know, there are some lawyers who are now beginning to bring cases to the courts. A group of European lawyers has taken the European Union Commission to court over their failures to act on the Gaza genocide. And it's called the Association of Jurists for the Respect of International Law. And they're saying that the European Union, under international law, and this is certainly true, it's not that there's no enforcement. They just are saying, no, we're not going to cooperate. The European Union and all of the member states of the United Nations General Assembly, according to international law, now should be suspending any cooperation with Israel, fulfilling their duty of prevention of genocide, imposing sanctions, and living up to this September 19th deadline. But instead, they continue shipping weapons, even groups that were part of the Hague Group Emergency Summit are still shipping weapons. I look at Ireland and I'm appalled. Ireland still has a factory operating in Limerick, making weapon components that they then ship to the Philippines, and the Philippines factory finishes it up, and then off they go to Israel. And Ireland is still making Shannon Airport available every day, morning, noon, and night, to planes that are bringing military equipment and soldiers into the region. And Ireland is supposed to be a neutral country.
Well, Ireland is one of the signatories that this statement was put out a few days ago by the foreign ministers of 30 countries with the United Kingdom putting that out. And Ireland was one of the signatories to that to stop the genocide, stop the support for Israel and its occupation of the territories. And yet here you're saying there's still this complicity.
Yeah. And Jimmy, I don't want to be a big scold or be shrill, but I mean, Spain has been so good. They Ireland, Spain, and Slovenia have declared Israel's war to be a genocide. They've said we're trying to get laws through our parliament. Colombia is trying, but there is a terrible double standard going on, because when they all wanted to enact sanctions against Russia, those were in place like overnight, practically, and they've been implemented. But, you know, you hear talk about, yeah, we're trying, oh, we're going to introduce a bill, but they're dragging their feet. I've now been with Code Pink New York, part of a group called the International Court Project, and we've met with about 22 of the permanent missions to the UN. And, you know, to their credit, they'll meet with us. Who are we, you know?
Right.
And they talk with us for an hour and a half, and they say, yes, we agree with you. We see what you're saying. You're right. Your research is correct. You know, we send them these big, long letters in advance saying, you know, here's what the law says. Here's what the Geneva Convention say, the genocide. And they agree. But then they say, well, really, you have to go to your country. And they're all afraid of what the United States might do to them because they're intertwined with U.S. military corporations, U.S. high-tech corporations, tourism, Airbnb, and so it's a toxic stew, and that's why I think civil society, ordinary people, now have the responsibility to try to see how we can say, okay, we're not going to consume the goods. We're not going to stand by and watch. We're going to raise our voices, take actions, hold die-ins. What an appropriate time it is now to just do a die-in when we know that people are dropping in the streets in Gaza because they're so malnourished. And the food hasn't gone in since it's well over 2 months.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
Again, I want to remind the listeners, this is Global Stuff. I'm talking with Kathy Kelly, who's been involved in a lot of ways with what's going on in that region and elsewhere in the world for and World Beyond War. She's the board president of that group and has been involved with many other organizations. We're talking about what is just a story that we hear more about every day. We hear more about, well, it's, they say the figure I hear is 50,000, but it could easily be more than that of people who have been killed. Mostly civilians and over, what, 150, they say, wounded and injured. And that's hard to track, too, when there's not even, we don't even have the hospitals to treat them, let alone to keep track of who's being injured. So we know it's an extreme situation. And, you know, it's good to raise public awareness, and I'm glad that Kathy is here to do that. But, you know, the question is, I think that's an important one. What can we do about it? You're talking about the complicity of U.S. corporations in supplying information that the Israeli and tools that the Israeli government and military use to conduct their campaign. I mentioned at the top the Hague Group, which specifically was formed in January of this year to try and bring some international attention to the situation and urge governments not to provide that kind of support. You mentioned the UN kind of throwing up its hands, or because of its involvement with the UN groups you've met with. But isn't there a resolution from the General Assembly that actually prohibits the cooperation with Israel in what it's doing in Gaza?
Glad you brought that up. There is something called the Uniting for Peace Resolution. And this is a resolution that had been created decades ago. But because the Emergency Commission on Gaza has never been closed down, it's still an open possibility. So this resolution could be enacted. And what has to happen is that a resolution for a ceasefire is proposed to the Security Council. And then if a country vetoes it, as the United States predictably does, then the General Assembly can enact this Uniting for Peace resolution and overturn the veto. and say, they could do a number of things. They could overturn the veto, they could suspend Israel from the United Nations, and they could say that Israel is no longer able to be part of the family of nations, and you know, the United States could be suspended as well. This has actually been enacted in the past. And interestingly, there was a time in the 50s when Britain and Germany tried to invade Gaza because of the Suez Canal control. And the United States, and they did this with Israel, and the United States didn't want to see the Suez Canal traffic interfered with. And so it was the U.S. that invoked this uniting for peace strategy. And next thing you knew, there were multinational UN-sponsored troops in the region, and Britain and France and Israel backed off, and the crisis was solved. So there are nonviolent ways. Now, I would not recommend sending more weapons into the region. I wouldn't recommend sending United Nations tanks and United Nations armed fighters. But I would recommend flooding the region with unarmed protectors. And, you know, just as I mentioned that some of the Jewish groups are uniting with international groups to go to the Bedouin villages in the West Bank, and that's happening now as we speak, that could be happening on a massive scale, and it should. So I urge your listeners to look into unarmed civilian protection in Palestine. That's unarmed civilian protection in Palestine. And that's going on, and people can be involved in it. And also, the Friends of the Hague group is a group that's been convened to kind of monitor, okay, so what is the Hague group going to do to follow up on what they said they would do? And then certainly, please be in touch with Code Pink's International Court Project.
Part of why I brought up that resolution, I'm glad you got into that more, because there is a petition that's circulating calling for the United Nations General Assembly to invoke its authority under the Uniting for Peace mechanism that is calling for a multinational protection force, but they're calling it an armed protection force. And that petition, you were saying you think it's that's a mistake. I mean, there's a number of groups that I'm sure that you're familiar with, such as the People Against Genocide Everywhere, the Palestine Christian Alliance for Peace, others, Partners for Palestine, that have signed this petition. Do you think there's any chance of some kind of a multinational force going in there? Is it the UN even close to considering that?
You know, truthfully, I'm not sure. And I would certainly want to acknowledge that I'm a part of a very small minority that want to advocate for unarmed civilian protection in Palestine as an alternative to sending in the tanks and the armed soldiers. And I mean, it would be, I do certainly want to see the barriers opened so that the food and the medicine and the tents and the fuel go in. And I want to see that reconstruction that's so desperately needed. I suppose right now what we're seeing is that as, you know, people sort of drag their feet and nothing happens, the Israelis are saying, okay, we can do this. We can force the Palestinians out. Why stop now? So would an armed military force going into that context be a wise way to go forward? I'm honestly not sure.
Well, we do have a caller. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for the show. Hi, Jimmy, Lauren here, and
hi, Lauren.
Your guest's work. I was actually I called before you started talking about that petition. I believe it's by Dawn, the nonprofit founded by the late Jamal Khashoggi, who was the Saudi journalist who was murdered. That petition is called UN General Assembly Deploy an Emergency Armed Multinational Protection Force to Gaza. Yeah, I was just going to bring that up, but since you already touched on it, I wanted to ask your host what they think about Jordan and other countries who are working right now to drop food aid. I want to get their opinion if you think the Israeli military will let that aid actually land.
Yeah, and, we did bring that up a little bit, but we can talk about that more, yeah.
Yeah, and also with the current Freedom Flotilla.
Oh, thank you, Lauren. I'm very glad you mentioned the effort to break the siege by sea. And the Handalah is getting quite close. They're in international waters, and by Saturday or Sunday, it's likely that they, if they're not blocked, they could land that boat with children's diapers and baby formula and toys that Italian children contributed and food. You know, it's symbolic. It's just maybe a drop in the bucket of what's needed. But yes, Lauren, it's getting closer and closer. And I hope we can all keep our eyes on that ship. The previous ships have been stopped. I remember I was on a flotilla.
Right. I was going to bring that up.
Yeah. So anyway, the Handalah is part of the Gaza. The U.S. boats to Gaza or the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. If you just go to Freedom Flotilla online, you'll be well connected. And Lauren, with regard to Jordan, Qatar, and Egypt collaborating with the Israeli military and the U.S. military to do airdrops, why the U.N. people are asking, why are you doing this when we've got the trucks laden with the necessary goods backed up at the Rafah border crossing, at other border crossings? We know how to distribute this, but that Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has been fraudulent and vicious in its luring of people to come and get desperately needed food and water, and only four sites are set up. People have to walk long distances, and then if they, you know, they haven't eaten for so long, and then they get some big heavy sack of flour and they have to carry it by foot. I mean, they don't even have donkey carts anymore. And so it's just a foolish, cruel project, and I can't wait to see it shut down. And so much money goes into the overhead to pay the executives that conjure up these plans. It's similar to when they built that floating dock and it got washed off to sea. These projects are distractions. And so my hope is that this obsession with having to get rid of every Hamas person, Hamas was running social services, they were part of universities, they were part of healthcare distribution. You can't just say, okay, we're wiping them all out overnight. It's just that it shows so little understanding of the culture.
Let me jump in here because we do have some other callers. Want to give them a chance to speak with you. Hi, you're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to try and be as gentle as I can with this, okay? First thing, I said one word about the 50 hostages that are still have been taken on October 7th, 2023. And so that's the issue. The issue is, we got the Jewish priests attacking the Islam priests, and the Catholics are in between. And so what it comes down to is this. What's the saddest room you've ever been in? The saddest room I've ever been in was 40 years ago when I was in Kashmir. Kashmir is one of those Islamic places where all the women wear veils, and the loudspeakers have prayers go through all the time. And there were six women in this room. They were all doing hand embroidery threading. The oldest one was just easily going through it, and she was paying more attention to me than any of them. And the other six were working hard at their cloth. Well, the youngest one was like 6 years old, and they had her working on a little triangle piece of cloth to make her do this embroidery. They never got out of Kashmir. They never had freedom.
Well, certainly Hamas should be held accountable for its terrible attacks on October 7th. And the hostages, I believe, should be released immediately. The idea of holding on to hostages as leverage so that you can make gains against your opponent, I think, is a pernicious idea. And I would like to see the release of the hostages. And I do apologize to your caller that I didn't bring that up. But I do not believe that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is interested in getting release of the hostages. That's why people all across Israel are out in the streets holding signs, banging pots there, saying release the hostages. The longer that he walked, I mean, they just walked away today again from the ceasefire talks, right, and they blamed Hamas. And I believe that this is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's best way to remain in power. And it's a good idea to listen to Omer Bartov, an Israeli professor, a former IDF soldier, someone who has written for the New York Times, that he has been a genocide scholar for years and years. And he says, I know a genocide when I see one. And he's Jewish. He says, this is a genocide.
We do have another caller. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, yeah, I don't think anybody can really argue that, you know, there's not a genocide unfolding in front of our eyes. I was listening to an Israeli Arab analyst who, you know, said that he was a Zionist and then he's now an anti-Zionist. But basically, he was analyzing the situation and he said that the political structure of Israel is essentially such that there's no, that you can't form a stable government because there's, you know, like infighting between some of the different groups, and essentially that they're all racist and Zionist, some, you know, pretending there's a center left or what have you, but even they are anti-Palestinian. So the Palestinians really don't have any voice in Israel. But what this analyst was saying is that this aggression, or basically that because of the instability of the government, the makeup of the government, it pushes them to continue to, like, create crisis after crisis. And essentially it's leading toward, like, he was fairly certain it was going to turn back towards Iran again in the near future. And he said, you know, basically all this aggression on Israel's part is going to be the undoing of Israel. So they're, I mean, they can do their propaganda line across, you know, the U.S. and Europe, and but they are losing the battle of the moral kind of high ground. So anyways, this guy basically said, like, all it would take is for Iran to degrade the IDF's ability to coordinate and respond, and that basically in Israel, most Jewish population is centered kind of in the middle, and a little 30 kilometers south and 30 kilometers north, there's a huge Palestinian population rest of the country that essentially, if the IDF is degraded, there could be an awful basically conflict with, like, a massive intifada, including Hezbollah. So I'm just going to stop rambling, but this is not good for Israel, and it's not good for Jews anywhere, and we need to be careful because our country is completely, not just complicit, like you said, we're partners. I don't think people realize, like, how close we're coordinating between the U.S., England, and Israel. The intelligence agencies, the Mossad, MI6, and CIA all closely work together. So to me, it seems like the reason there's no international response, it seems conspiratorial, just how coordinated it is, like how much control spreads across so many countries in the world. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. Well, let's let Kathy jump in on that as well. I do want to remind the listeners we're getting towards the end of the show. This is Global Stuff. My name is Jimmy Derschlag. My guest, Kathy Kelly, who is the board president of World Beyond War, and longtime activist talking about the situation in Gaza, which is so much front and center these days. What I'm interested in is his comments on the Israeli political structure and their inability to change the situation there.
Well, thank you for those comments. The very far right-wing ministers in the Israeli cabinet have routinely issued horrendous statements saying that we want to get rid of all of the Palestinians. We want to press this. And so you'll find that, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu's office will say, well, you know, that's them, that's not us. But he needs, as your caller has said, to keep his coalition together. And it's very dependent on some extremely right-wing ideologues who make statements that would seem to endorse the idea that Israel is definitely committing genocide. And I think the other thing that we have to keep in mind is that in the Negev Desert, there's a huge underground tunnel. And okay, you know, Hamas dug tunnels and Hamas bought weapons in through the tunnels. But the most dangerous tunnel is the Shimon Peres Nuclear Research Center in Dimona, which has produced at least 91 thermonuclear weapons. So we're talking about a nuclear armed power. And, you know, there's always the fear that, you know, the Samson complex idea that Israel could say, well, we'll bring the whole house down if you don't give us what we want. So the stakes are high. You know, Martin Luther King, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King said, you know, we have a choice, nonviolent cooperation or non-cooperative annihilation. If we don't figure out how to collaborate with one another. And, you know, I think it is important to ask what would the land boundaries be if there were a two-state solution. And on the 27th of this month at the UN, Saudi Arabia and France are convening a two-state solution conference. And that was supposed to happen 2 months ago, but when Israel started attacking Iran, the conference was called off. And, you know, people aren't really sure what's on the agenda for that conference, who exactly is going to be presenting. The first one was going to have 8 different committees, and it was going to go on for about a week, and this one is just 2 days long. But which borders would be acceptable if there were a two-state solution? There's a great concern that a two-state solution could be developed which gives the Palestinians like a collection of Bantustans surrounded by military roadways and checkpoints with no access to the sea or no access to their, you know, finest resources. And if the Palestinians agree to that, then, you know, they'd end up having Saudi Arabia perhaps be the broker for peace in their region. Well, why should that be? The Saudis, you know, as was mentioned by your earlier caller, you know, they chopped up Jamal Khashoggi. They mercilessly bombed Yemen for years and years and starved people in Yemen, caused cholera, I believe, through bombing the infrastructure. Why have the Saudis be the brokers for peace? Why have the U.S. be the brokers for peace? You know, our history has had genocide and terrible persecution of people of color. So I think people have to be really careful to ask just that question. What would the land boundaries be if there was a two-state solution? And my belief is that the best solution would be one collective homeland, one collective homeland for Palestinians, Christians, Jews to live together and be a shining example of people learning to live together without killing one another and finding ways to collaborate. Now, in South Africa, they underwent years of truth and reconciliation commissions following the ousting of the illegal South African government. And that's an excruciating process, but it's not impossible. It's been demonstrated before.
And many other guests that I've had on this show have come to, have said the same thing. Every proposal for a two-state solution really has never really made sense. And historically, there was a time when there was more of a unified population there in what was all Palestine before there was Israel. But
Jimmy, could I say it's so interesting to look up the biography of Count Foch Bernadotte. He was somebody who rescued many thousands of European Jews and got them to safety. And so he was then appointed after the Balfour Declaration, after, you know, Israel had been given to as a Jewish homeland, and many Palestinians then had been forcibly displaced. He was brought in to try to design a better solution, and he did. He and Ralph Bunche came up with a solution calling for an Arab state and an Israeli state side by side, and he was assassinated, and probably they would have assassinated Ralph Bunche as well, but he happened not to be in the car that he was expected to be in. And I think Count Foch Bernadotte could have saved more lives than he saved when he saved the European Jews and got them out of the Nazi Gestapo's hands. He could have saved more lives if his plan had been allowed to go forward. But a paramilitary group of Israeli soldiers came up to the car he was riding in, and they shot him dead. Just before, just a day after he was going to make this proposal to the United Nations.
In the few minutes we have left, I want to bring it back to a perspective on what's going on here in the United States. We've talked about that some. I don't want to get into the Trump policies. We know they've walked out of the talks today, the representatives of the U.S. government, because they said Hamas doesn't want to negotiate. But there, just a few days ago, there was a demonstration in the Capitol. Jewish Voices for Peace and there are a lot of Jewish voices, but there's such pushback. The student from the university who it was arrested and released and now pushing back against that.
Mahmoud Khalil.
But anyway, just, you know, even though there's so much outcry against what's going on in Gaza, there's still an incredible amount of pushback in the United States for anyone who says anything against Israel and what they're doing, and certainly no real action in Congress against that. Maybe some few of the more progressive representatives, but so little of that. And is there something that people can do about that, or what's your perspective on how out of the international reaction to Gaza the not only our government, but so many of our fellow citizens are?
Well, I was so impressed by the student movement and, you know, the way that they displaced themselves and lived in tents and created a wonderful example worldwide of nonviolent direct action. And they wanted to know, where is our university money going? How much is invested in these various weapon-making companies or high-tech companies? And they were squelched. But I don't think they're down and out entirely. I would expect we'll hear more from the students. And I think that It was so sad to see that only six congresspeople voted against the next bill to send more weapons to Israel. Bernie Sanders had introduced it in the Senate, and there was introduced a companion bill in the Congress to say stop the arms. And there were only six congresspeople who gave support to that. Even the squad, Alexandria Cortez didn't support this important measure. But we have to keep trying. When congresspeople are back in their districts and holding town halls, we have to go to those meetings and raise our voices and make it known that we don't want to be partners any longer in this hideous genocide. You know, today the Knesset voted symbolically to annex the West Bank, and you had Israeli ministers, as I mentioned, calling for mass expulsions and the settlement of Gaza by Israelis. If we don't stop this now, I believe it could have, you know, effects on our country too, because the technology that's being used to surveil and track and kill people in Gaza and the West Bank could be turned on people that ICE wants to track, or maybe, you know, people that are seen to be speaking up too much. So now is the time for us to remember the bravery of those two siblings, Hans and Sophie Scholl, in Germany, in Munich, who stood up, who said, we are not going to let our lives be governed by fear. And those are tall orders, aren't they? We catch courage from one another. And so I hope we'll all continue to catch the courage that we see around us and stand up to genocide, to land grabs and theft and siege and starvation, and say we cannot say we did not know.
And you certainly are a great example of that, Kelly, Kathy, for all the things you've done, Kathy Kelly. Just a real shining example to us of someone who's put her life on the line in the causes that you represent. I'm so pleased that you're able to make the time to be on the program. People can go to the World Beyond War website, but there's so many places they can go to learn more about things that they can do.
This has been a KMUT podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.